Hi, everybody. This is Gary Sandy, and thank you very much for listening to the WKRP cast.
So just sit right down, relax, open your ears real wide, and say...
Weather today in the greater Cincinnati area.
Are you awake? Whoa! Are you awake now?
But the senator, while insisting he was not intoxicated, could not explain his nudity.
Say what?
Dear God, she's going to kill us all.
Welcome to the WKRP cast. My name is Alan Stair.
And I'm Donna Stair. This is the fourth and final season of our week-by-week, episode-by-episode rewatch.
Join us for this final season as we're getting into the music,
the trivia, and the fun of WKRP.
So, fellow babies, stay tuned and stay cool. It's time for the WKRP cast.
I'm a WKRP in Cincinnati.
Welcome back to the WKRP cast. This week we are on the edge of our seats. What's our episode, Donna?
We're talking about An Explosive Affair, Part 1. It aired on October 7th, 1981, written by Steve Marshall, story editors Steve Marshall and Dan Gunselman, executive story consultant Lisa Levin. This one was directed by Linda Day. In the first of this two-part episode, WKRP receives a terrorist bomb threat.
Welcome to season four. It's the fourth and sadly final season of WKRP. Of course, a new season, so you know what that means.
A new time slot?
Oh, yeah, but at least this fall they're moving out of Saturday Night and the Wasteland to something where they might be able to build an audience. Wednesday nights at 8:30. Being at 8:30 means they've got a lead-in. It's called Mr. Merlin. It was a one-season sitcom produced by Larry Rosen. Larry Rosen is known for a couple of things. He produced The Mike Douglas Show for 124 episodes. He was also the producer of The Partridge Family. And Larry Rosen was married to Dawn Wells. That's right, Mary Ann from Gilligan's Island.
The Professor and Mary Ann here on Gilligan's Island.
Mr. Merlin was not one of Rosen's more notable achievements. It did star Emmy and Tony Award-winning character actor Barnard Hughes. The problem may have been with the storyline. Hughes was playing Max Merlin, the owner of a rundown automotive shop in San Francisco. Unbeknownst to anyone, Max was actually the immortal Merlin, the wizard of King Arthur's court. The first season followed Merlin's attempts to train a young employee at the garage as his heir apparent. Much of the comedy was derived from his protege, 15-year-old Zach, fouling up his magic.
It's October 7th, which means this episode is airing a bit later in the fall than usual for a season premiere. It was about this time programmers were experimenting with rolling fall premieres. In the mid to late 70s, fall season new show premieres would all happen in a week or two in early September. Network executives realized a premiere could drive up overall viewership for a night. Reruns or new episodes from ongoing series would get a bump if they ran the same night as a show premiere. Instead of wasting the draw of new series premieres all at once, the idea of rolling premieres caught on fast. It would not be unusual to find multiple new series premieres on at least one network each week throughout the fall. Tonight, October 7th, is the CBS series premiere of Mr. Merlin and the season premiere of WKRP. The strategy worked. They had a big night. Mr. Merlin finished the week at number 16. The WKRP premiere would be slightly better with a number 15 finish.
Unfortunately, Mr. Merlin would not prove to be a powerhouse. It will hold for a second week, finishing number 17 with its second episode. Sadly, nobody cared if Venus and Johnny were blown up. The second part of this episode of WKRP would slip to number 30 for the week. The bloom was off the rose for Mr. Merlin after the second week. Whoever had tried it out premiere night was not making it a regular part of their Wednesday night TV viewing. Throughout the fall, Mr. Merlin and WKRP would slide down the ratings in tandem. WKRP seems to be at the mercy of a bad lead-in. Just 4 weeks from now, Mr. Merlin will finish at number 54 and WKRP at number 57 for the week. Enough bad ratings news. Let's get into the episode.
We start out in the lobby where Jennifer is at her desk as Bailey enters from the door that leads back to the bullpen. Bailey asks Jennifer if she can buy her lunch, but Jennifer says she already has plans.
Oh, plans, you say? Well, I think you'll change your mind when I tell you that I happen to have a 2-for-1 coupon at Bounty Burger.
Bailey asks Jennifer what she has that beats Bounty Burger.
Haute cuisine from La Maisonette. Andrea's having it catered in.
Oh, well, what the heck. I guess I'll have to slam down 2 half-pounders myself.
Bailey leaves the lobby.
Jennifer mentioned haute cuisine, which made us go, huh? Haute cuisine is a French style of cooking, also known as grand cuisine. It is the cuisine of high-level establishments, gourmet restaurants, and luxury hotels. Haute distinguishes itself from regular French cuisine by what is served, and also by the high level and rarity of ingredients, such as using out-of-season fruit or ingredients not typically found in France.
Bailey said she was going to scarf down a couple of Bounty Burgers. We looked, and as far as we can tell, there's no evidence of a place called Bounty Burger having ever been in Cincinnati. These days, if you're looking for a good burger in Cincy, don't miss the Brew Burger Bar, the Tickle Pickle Restaurant, or Jack Brown's Beer and Burger Joint featuring the Cobra Kai Burger.
And we are going to go to the Tickle Pickle.
We got to go to the Tickle Pickle. Yeah.
Jennifer gathers some papers from her desk and she heads through the door leading to the bullpen. The lobby is empty. A tall, professional-looking woman carrying a satchel enters from the main doors. Seeing the lobby is empty, she eyes the receptionist's desk and slowly walks over and sits in Jennifer's chair. She looks at ease behind the desk as she lays her satchel and purse beside her. The phone rings. She looks at it for a moment, then picks it up.
WKRP? Mr. Carlson? He's in a strategy conference. No, he didn't say that's part of the strategy. Thank you.
She hangs up the phone. Whoa, now who is this person invading Jennifer's space?
Jennifer walks back into the lobby and sees the woman sitting at her desk. She asks if she can help.
May I help you?
The woman stands and turns. When she sees Jennifer, they recognize each other and hug.
Jennifer? Joyce! Oh!
What? Joyce Armour is being played by Rosemary Forsyth. First, we have to mention the character name of Joyce Armour. It might sound familiar to you because this is a shout-out to real-life writer and production assistant Joyce Armour. Joyce was PA on the WKRP pilot. She was a writer on the Tony Randall Show. She also co-wrote Bailey's Show and Ask Jennifer with writing partner Judy Neer. That's where the name comes from. Not to be confused with the actress playing Joyce, whose real name is Rosemary Forsyth.
We knew there was some reason we liked Rosemary. She's Canadian. Rosemary was born in Montreal in July of 1943. She moved to New York at age 5 with her divorced mother. Mom was seeking work as a model. Rosemary followed in her footsteps. By 1965, she'd earned a Golden Globe nomination as Promising Newcomer for her role in Shenandoah with James Stewart. At the time, reviewers noted her striking resemblance to Grace Kelly. Rosemary has worked pretty consistently over 5 decades. She was most active in the 70s and 80s. Rosemary has 83 credits listed on her IMDb profile. Many of those are multiple episode arcs, including 110 episodes of Days of Our Lives and 40 episodes of Santa Barbara. Rosemary's last appearance was in a 2008 made-for-TV movie starring Jeff Daniels and Marlee Matlin.
You certainly aren't the same girl who stumbled in here from Rock Pile, West Virginia.
Rock Throw.
Oh, wherever.
Jennifer asks Joyce how she is, where she's been, and what she's been doing. Joyce tells her that she is still in broadcasting.
But I'm not a receptionist anymore.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I'm an account executive for a rep firm.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And I moved to Cleveland.
Oh, that's nice.
Herb enters the office in a great mood. He's singing Hot Diggity as he walks up to the two women.
Diggity dog diggity boom, what you do to me boom. Have I got a deal for you, Jenny Poo.
And as Herb steps into the lobby,
it's time.
Herb Darlick, fashion alert.
Herb is wearing a shades of gray plaid jacket with solid navy blue pocket flaps and collar. He's wearing navy blue pants, a white checked dress shirt, maroon tie with white circles, his white belt, and signature white shoes.
Herb is a symphony in geometric shapes this time. He's got squares and circles and all kinds of things happening
on
that outfit.
And I like the way he focuses on pocket flaps.
Yes, the pocket flaps are always a spectacle with a Herb outfit.
They pop.
Herb entered the lobby singing Hot Diggity. Except for the Love American Style theme, we're pretty sure every song Herb has ever sung on the show is a number one hit. This is no exception. Hot Diggity was a number one for Perry Como in March of 1956. The parenthetical phrase in the title is Dog Ziggity Boom.
Oh, hot diggity, dog ziggity boom, what you do to me? It's so new to me. What you do to me? Hot diggity, dog ziggity boom, what you do to me? When you're holding me tight.
Never dreamed anybody could kiss that away, bring me bliss that away, what a kiss that away, what a
Como's
wonderful...
backing vocals come from the Ray Charles Singers. The phrase Hot Diggity Dog dates to 1928. Al Jolson was recorded saying it following his performance of There's a Rainbow Round My Shoulder. You might be familiar with the song from an ad. The lyrics were revised, and Hot Diggity was used as a jingle in a series of late 70s Oscar Mayer Wiener TV commercials.
America made the hot dog famous. Oscar Mayer gave it Diggity.
Hot Diggity Dog, Diggity, boom, what you do to me? Oscar Mayer gives hot dogs Diggity. I'm pretty sure that Oscar Mayer Wiener Dog Diggity. That's what I totally like to be. Ooh, hot Diggity Dog, Diggity, boom.
America's number one.
Joyce smiles at Herb and does a little finger wiggle wave.
Hi, little guy.
Herb looks up and recognizes Joyce. He says hello, takes her by the shoulders, and looks right at her.
Little guy.
Listen, ixnay on the little guy stuff, you know.
Herb does a small nod of his head toward Jennifer.
Little guy? Ooh, gee, I don't know, Herb. I think it kind of suits you.
Herb turns and sneers at Jennifer and then looks back at Joyce.
So, Joyce, back for one more desperate try at my job, huh?
No, sorry, I got some other poor loser's job.
Herb used the word ixnay when he was talking about calling him little guy. Ixnay is the Pig Latin word for nix, which is German. Nix means literally nothing. It's used as a Pig Latin word to mean something that shouldn't be mentioned. Ixnay and amscray, or scram in English, are the only two Pig Latin words to have crossed over into regular English usage. Both words were used extensively by the Three Stooges in their movies and shorts.
Hey, what are you guys doing, talking behind my back?
Nobody's talking behind your back. That's Pig Latin.
Sure, anybody can understand it. It's very simple.
Well, I can't, and I'm simple.
Now, listen. You tell him.
My name is Mo. In Pig Latin, that's Ome.
My name is Larry. Now, what's that in Pig Latin?
Ome.
Oh. It's Harry Lay.
Boy, are you umde.
Oh, you mean I'm umde in pig language?
You're umde in any language.
Oh, thank you.
The Stooges are considered the reason for the popularity of these words and even the popularity of Pig Latin. And amazingly, ixnay is not getting underlined by word here in our script to indicate a misspelling. Amscray is getting underlined, but not ixnay.
The door to Mr. Carlson's office opens. Mr. Carlson comes out carrying his fishing rod.
Jennifer, could you give me a hand with this?
Mr. Carlson turns his back to Jennifer, and we see that he has the hook from his fishing line caught in his suit jacket. He moves the fishing rod up and down for a great visual. The tail of his suit coat jumps up and down as he moves the rod. It then dawns on him.
Good gravy. Is that Joyce Armour I see?
The best little receptionist I ever had.
Jennifer turns and looks at Mr. Carlson.
Oh,
Mr. Carlson begins to backpedal.
Not the first best. not second best either. I mean, she was the first. But not the first best.
Easy, Mr. Carlson, you'll hurt yourself.
Jennifer takes Mr. Carlson by the arm.
Joyce looks at Art.
Do you want me to help you untangle that?
Oh, no, I can do that.
No, that's okay, Jennifer. Thanks a lot. Joyce? Huh?
Carlson turns to go into his office and he motions for Joyce to follow. As she walks to Art's office, she says how good it is to see everyone again.
It's so good to see you after all this time, and Jennifer, and the little guy, and...
Little guy? I'd forgotten all about that big guy, little guy.
Oh, yeah, they're rekindling that little guy thing. The two go into Art's office, and the door closes.
Looking a bit perturbed, Herb heads to the door.
If anybody wants me, I'll be at lunch.
Roger, LG.
Jennifer's smiling. Herb pauses at the door for a bit, then he continues on out. Andy walks into the lobby from the bullpen door and puts some folded papers on Jennifer's desk. Jennifer asks what he wants her to do with them.
File the complaints about Johnny, and you better call the police about the bomb threat.
And we were talking, how big do you think that
That's
folder
a thick
is
file, yes.
With Johnny's complaints in it?
Andy heads back to the bullpen. Jennifer picks up the phone and begins to dial, and then, holding the receiver away from her ear, she realizes what Andy had just said. She gets a lost look on her face as she stares straight ahead.
As Jennifer calls the cops, we head into our theme.
WKRP in Cincinnati.
We come back from our first break in Art's office, where Mr. Carlson is holding his fishing rod. Joyce looks around his office. She speaks, thinking out loud.
Same old office, same old desk.
Yeah, same old fish on the walls. You know, I haven't hauled in a big one since.
Florida Keys.
Yeah, I'm going down there again next week.
Gee,
boy,
it's good to
see.
Joyce and Art laugh. Mr. Carlson tells Joyce she always did know what he was going to say before he did. Joyce asks if he still tries to dictate his memos, or does Jennifer type them up from longhand?
Well, you know, we really haven't gotten around to that yet.
Art turns so Joyce can get the fishing hook out of his jacket.
Art said he was heading to the Florida Keys for some fishing. The Keys are a Coral Cay archipelago located off the southern coast of Florida. Key is a word derived from the Spanish cayo, meaning small island. The Keys form the southernmost part of the continental United States. The largest city in the Keys is Key West. The Keys and Key West are accessible by a single road, U.S. Highway 1. In 1982, U.S. Border Patrol agents were regularly stopping cars on U.S. 1 to search for illegal drugs and immigrants. The stops were hurting Key's tourism to the point that the mayor of Key West filed a lawsuit to halt the blockade of U.S. 1. When the lawsuits didn't work, Key West took a drastic step. They decided to secede from the Union.
That's very drastic.
Yes.
On April 23rd of 1982, the mayor and city council officially declared Key West had seceded from the United States to form the Conch Republic. The secession lasted for 1 minute. At that time, the mayor, or prime minister for that minute, surrendered to an officer of the Key West Naval Air Station. The Conch Republic then requested $1 billion in foreign aid. The stunt was huge for the Keys. It forced an end to the blockade of U.S. 1, and these days, locals have a whole new revenue source in Conch Republic merchandise.
Still trying to free the hook from Mr. Carlson's jacket, Joyce asks how Carmen is. Mr. Carlson awkwardly turns to face Joyce, and he clumsily knocks the fishing pole out of his hand when it hits his desk.
Art needs to stop moving.
He's a nervous wreck. I think Joyce makes him all jittery.
I think so.
Joyce is trying to untangle fishing line as Mr. Carlson says that Carmen is great.
And she's a little busy now with the new baby and all.
The baby? Oh, I didn't know. That's wonderful.
I got a picture here.
Carlson reaches for his billfold in his back pocket, causing the fishing line to become even more tangled. Joyce tells him that she will look at it later.
She's a year old now. Her name's Melanie.
Joyce suggests that they go to lunch at Emilio's, and she can look at the baby pictures then.
Hey, did you catch it? That was our first time that we got a name on the baby, Melanie.
We knew it was a girl.
Knew it was a girl, but we never got a name. We did not find an Emilio's in Cincinnati. We did find Emilio Morales on LinkedIn. Emilio graduated from the University of Cincinnati College of Business, and he's currently the general manager at Salsa's Mexican restaurant. So, Emilio, salute.
Somebody needs to call him up and have him listen to this episode of our podcast. Mr. Carlson tells Joyce he has another lunch engagement in about 30 minutes. Both of them continue to struggle with the fishing line. It's wrapped around them even worse than before. Mr. Carlson says he hasn't eaten at Emilio's in ages.
To tell the truth, I've really been looking for an excuse to get out of this luncheon. It's what? With the Liver Advisory Board. What am I going to tell him?
Why don't you tell him you're all tied up?
Mr. Carlson walks over to his phone, dragging Joyce with him because they are all wrapped up in fishing line. He picks up the receiver and asks her to dial the number as he gives it to her.
Art mentioned he was on the Liver Advisory Board. Now, I kind of figured the joke was he's talking about beef liver. It's the food kids famously hate.
We tried to look this one up and found a ton of liver advisory boards. Actually, both boards and groups, but they're all medical and they're all talking about human livers.
I don't think Art was on one of those boards. I don't know that I'd trust him on a human liver board.
I don't know if he was on it. He said he was going to have
going
a lunch
to the luncheon
meeting.
With him, yeah. We head into the studio, which means it's time for a poster watch.
Yay!
Strap in, gang. It's a new season, which means a lot of new posters.
The poster to the top of the studio door is a promo for Wanted, Dread, or Alive. It's the fifth studio album for Jamaican reggae musician Peter Tosh. Tosh, along with Bob Marley and Bunny Wailer, had created the genre of reggae music as the Wailers in the mid-1960s. Tosh had written many of the Wailers' biggest hits, including Get Up, Stand Up.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Citing unfair treatment by their record label, Tosh and Bunny Wailer left the Wailers in 1974. Tosh issued his first solo album, Legalize It, in 1976. Tosh was murdered in 1987 as part of a home invasion and robbery at his residence in Jamaica.
Legalize It. What do you think the it is? There are three ladies recreating the spirit of 76 in the poster on the door under Peter Tosh. They're promoting the label Stiff Records. We never get to see it, but across the bottom of the poster is the phrase Stiff America. Below that is the line, selected by shoplifters, ignored by intellectuals. Stiff Records was founded as an independent in the UK in 1976. Stiff was devoted to pub rock, punk rock, and new wave. Stiff signed young punk and new wave acts like Nick Lowe, Lenny Lovitch, Elvis Costello, Madness, and Devo. Once these acts would hit, they would leave Stiff and move on to a bigger label. Stiff was active from 1976 through 86. The label was reactivated in 2007, and in 2017, Stiff was acquired by Universal Music Group.
There's a Rolling Stones poster to the right of Venus over on the far right of the Cincinnati map. It's a real mouth and tongue with a banner over it. This is a die-cut promo poster for the Rolling Stones' 1981 album, Tattoo You. Tattoo You was a collection of Stones outtakes from the 70s. It did yield one of their most well-known songs, Start Me Up, which went to number 2 on the U.S. Hot 100. This poster was never sold to the public. It was only available to record stores for in-store display. The scroll banner over the top says, Rolling Stones. The mouth is actually Mick Jagger's. To the bottom left, on the real tongue, is a tattoo of the Rolling Stones mouth and tongue logo with a sword through it, flowers around it, and a banner across the bottom that says, Tattoo You. If you can find it, this poster is bringing about $125 in 2022.
Under the Cincinnati map, behind Venus's stool, is another die cut. This is a promo poster for The Tubes' April 1981 album, Completion Backwards Principle. The Tubes were a San Francisco rock group formed in 1975 and fronted by a guy named Fee Waybill. This was their 5th studio album, but it was their first for Capitol Records and their first working with producer David Foster. The album graphic is a T-shaped piece of PVC pipe, which casts a shadow on a blue background. The band is listed only as Tubes on the album cover. The single, Don't Want to Wait Anymore, became the band's first top 40 hit, peaking at number 35 for 2 weeks on the U.S. Hot 100. The other single, Talk to You Later, would only bubble under the Hot 100. It peaked at number 101. It would go on to become well known as the sign-off song for hundreds of DJs throughout the country.
Yeah, if you look under the window to the left of the studio door, you're seeing the outline of a tank. It's Joe Walsh with another die-cut promo poster. This one was for Joe's 5th studio album, There Goes the Neighborhood. It came out in May of 1981. The single, Life of Illusion, was an old track. Joe had originally recorded it in 1973 with his band Barnstorm, but it was never completed. The final overdubs and mixes happened during the sessions for this album. The album would peak at number 20 on the U.S. album chart. The single will only go to number 34 in May of 1981. Although Life of Illusion is not Joe's biggest hit, it does become one of his most popular songs.
Let's get into the studio. Johnny is at the mic and Venus is sitting on the stool talking on the phone. We hear Can't Stop Hurting Myself by the Greg Kinn Band. Venus is placing a bet over the phone.
We both want Oklahoma and get the spread.
Oklahoma?
Why Chinese bookie, John?
He takes slow pay, gives good egg roll.
Johnny gets on the mic and we learn it's 12:47 p.m. Johnny's pulling a double shift. He's sitting in for Rex Earhart. He starts the song, Sweet Soul Music by Arthur Conley.
If you think that you got all the answers, just remember way back in 1967 when Arthur Conley asked the question.
Do you like good music?
Andy enters the studio just as Venus is hanging up the phone.
Okay, Wing. Wing? Yeah, I just ordered some chicken for Johnny and me.
Uh-huh. What kind of odds is the chicken giving?
Andy's picked up a piece of paper and is looking at some figures written on it.
Leave it to Johnny to not play the hits. He was coming out of Can't Stop Hurting Myself, This was the first single from Greg Kinn's 1981 album with the pun title Rockin' Roll. Johnny has the record sleeve from Rockin' Roll sitting in front of him. Can't Stop didn't do anything chart-wise. The second release from this album, the breakup song, They Don't Write 'Em, was the breakout hit from this album. It went to number 15 in May of 1981. Howard Hessman may have known Greg Kinn. He was from Baltimore, but he moved to San Francisco in 1972. He was sometimes known to play on the streets.
Sweet Soul Music, on the other hand, was a huge hit for Arthur Conley in 1967. It was written by Conley and Otis Redding. The track went to number 2 on the Hot 100. It was unable to unseat The Happening from Diana Ross and the Supremes, which had the number 1 spot. The song is an homage to soul music. It mentions several songs and groups, describing James Brown as king of them all.
Spotlight on James Brown, y'all.
Soul Music sold more than 1 million copies, and it did earn Conley a gold disc.
Johnny grabs the paper from Andy's hands, and he rips it up.
What is it? You think we're gambling here, right? Another merry mix-up.
Andy crosses his arms and looks at them both.
You guys, remember what I said I was going to do the last time you pulled
Andy,
this?
I called the police. They're on their way.
Oh, thank you, Jennifer.
The police?
Jennifer closes the door and leaves.
A little harsh, Travis.
Andy tells him, no, it's not about that. It's about a bomb threat.
Excuse me?
Andy repeats.
Bomb threat.
Excuse me.
Johnny and Venus head for the door of the studio.
Andy stops them from leaving, telling them when a station gets popular, these things happen. Bomb threats, crank calls. And it's standard procedure. You have to call the police.
These things are almost always hoaxes. See, now, we'd have felt a lot better if you said they were always hoaxes.
Les comes into the studio. He asks, what are always hoaxes?
Bomb threats, Les.
Actually, they're almost always hoaxes.
Les goes on to say the bombing in Dayton last month was real. And he asks Les what he's talking about.
Someone blew up Channel 73 right in the middle of the John Davidson show.
Les tells him it was awful. A group called Black Monday claimed credit for it. He tells them to get out. They all leave the studio.
Andy referenced this as a bomb threat. Bomb threats are a relatively modern development. They first started happening during the American Civil Rights Movement in the 1960s. Martin Luther King Jr. would receive multiple bomb threats before public addresses. Integrated schools were also targeted. Central High in Arkansas received 43 bomb threats with no actual bombs. Les and Andy are both right about them almost always being hoaxes.
Usually, an actual bomber will strike without warning. A real bomber doesn't want anyone to know they've planted a bomb, so they won't call in a threat. Real bombers don't want anyone looking for their bomb, and they're and they're hoping for maximum casualties, so they don't want anyone to run away from it. The bomb threat is usually made for political reasons. The person making the threat wants to disrupt some activity. Some bomb threats are for extortion or ransom purposes. Many bomb threats have also been chalked up to a joke, someone's sick idea of entertainment.
John Davidson is just an all-around nice guy with a handsome face, great hair, and a beautiful smile. We don't know why anyone would want to blow up his show. John was born the son of two Baptist ministers in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in December of 1941. He's been an actor, singer, and game show host throughout his long career. For 2 years, from 1980 to 1982, 457 episodes to be exact, John hosted his own daytime comedy variety musical talk show called The John Davidson Show.
From Hollywood, it's the John Davidson Show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's the star of our show, John Davidson.
It ran in syndication throughout the country, so it wasn't on at any certain time of day. There are only 6 full-power television stations in Dayton these days, and none of them is Channel 73. So either Channel 73 was made up for this episode, or they never recovered from being bombed.
We couldn't find a terrorist group called Black Monday, especially one operating in the Cincinnati area in the early 80s. There was an event in 1977 in Youngstown, Ohio. On September 19th, 5,000 workers from the Youngstown Sheet and Tube plant were laid off. That event is still referred to around Youngstown as Black Monday.
We think the name of the group for this episode may have been inspired by the 1977 film Black Sunday. In it, a deranged Bruce Dern pilots the Goodyear blimp loaded with explosives over the Super Bowl. There was also the group Black September, who operated in the early 1970s. They were behind the 1972 massacre of athletes from Israel's Olympic team who were competing in Munich.
Les is watching the time closely as Sweet Soul Music continues to play. Not waiting for the song to finish, Les does a horrible thing. He grabs the arm of the turntable and tosses it off to the side. It goes completely off the body of the turntable.
It actually bounces.
Bounces back. Then he flips the album off the turntable and onto the console.
Time for the news with Les Messman.
Out in the lobby, Jennifer is standing beside a man as he sits at her desk on the phone. And wow, this guy looked a lot like Andy when we first saw him. He's got the hair.
Officer Mardigan is being played by the dashing Lou Richards. And wow, looking down Lou's list of acting credits, we were amazed at how many times we've seen this guy over the years and didn't know it. He's worked a lot, starting back in 1977. Lou has 118 listed credits on his IMDb profile, but that represents a huge number of episodes of TV. Lou was Deputy Dennis Putnam on the Suzanne Summers sitcom She's the Sheriff for all 45 episodes. He was the voice of the Flash for 65 episodes of the animated Defenders of Earth TV series. He was on 21 episodes of 1982's All in the Family spinoff, Gloria. He did 63 episodes as Leader One on Challenge of the GoBots and many more. Most recently, Lou was in the 2021 movie, The Man from Nowhere. A fun tidbit about Lou, he got that GoBots gig because the voice director was Gordon Hunt. Gordon's daughter, the 21-year-old Helen Hunt, had a secret crush on Lou, and she asked her dad to cast him for the job.
He was very nice looking.
Oh, yeah. He's quite the dashing guy. He and John Davidson could go cruising on Friday night and just kill the ladies.
They cause a stir.
Yeah.
Mr. Carlson and Joyce come out of his office. Jennifer introduces Mr. Carlson to Officer Mardigan.
Oh, fine. What can we do for you?
Leave the building.
Fine.
Mr. Carlson and Joyce walk out of the lobby. The officer tells the person at the other end of the line it will be a full building search. Jennifer tells the officer she'll go get Mr. Travis for him.
Mr. Travis?
Yes.
Andy, Johnny, and Venus come out of the door from the bullpen. Andy's walking backwards in front of them as they're hurrying out of the station. He has one arm out trying to physically stop them.
Now, come on. Now, listen, we have a responsibility here to our listeners.
Right. If I die, who's going to teach the children about Bo Diddley?
Jennifer starts to introduce Andy to the bomb squad officer, but Andy just guesses he's from the bomb squad.
Well, not the whole squad. I just look for him. The fire department guys dismantle him.
Johnny has to teach the children about Bo Diddley. We've talked about Elias Bates McDaniel, a.k.a. Bo Diddley, and his 5-accent hambone rhythm before. Diddley was born in Macomb, Mississippi, but he became Bo Diddley both on the streets and in the blues clubs of Chicago.
Andy asked the officer to please tell Johnny and Venus not to panic.
Don't panic. and leave the building.
Johnny and Venus go ahead and start to head out, but Andy stops them.
This is almost always a joke, right, sir?
Oh, no. Not since the John Davidson incident.
Johnny and Venus try to leave again, but Andy stops them one more time.
You guys are going to have to broadcast from the transmitter. Now, do you know where it is?
Tall thing with red lights on the top out in the country. We'll find it.
Andy's persistent.
Yeah.
Venus asks if they can't talk about this outside. Andy says okay, and that one of them should take some albums, and he'll put on a tape until they get to the transmitter. Johnny and Venus look at each other.
Well, what?
Well, go back in there and get the albums.
Which brings us to...
the line of the episode.
Need I remind you that the police are going to search every inch of this station, including your desk drawer?
I'll get those albums.
Johnny runs back through the bullpen door.
Yeah, some things will make you brave.
Nobody should be finding anything in there.
Jennifer is very calmly covering her phone with its cover, getting ready to leave, when Officer Mardigan comes out of Art's office. Pointing at the door leading to the bullpen, he asks Jennifer what's through there. She tells him the studios. Then she asks,
don't you have dogs for this?
Officer Mardigan hangs his head and he gets a sad look on his face.
We did.
Oh, man. He looks at Jennifer, then walks through the door, heading back to the bullpen area.
Ouch. Sounds like there might have been an incident involving Cincinnati's bomb-sniffing dogs. The most popular breeds used for bomb-sniffing are German Shepherds and Labrador Retrievers. The dogs detect bomb vapors. They are trained on the smells associated with each of the five explosives families. They've been proven accurate even when it comes to detecting trace amounts of explosive material. Cincinnati may not be able to afford dog replacements. Training a bomb-sniffing dog is not easy or cheap. The TSA currently pays $218,000 in startup costs per dog trained. Then they pay an additional $158,000 per year to keep the dog trained and ready.
Andy comes out of the door into the lobby calling for Les to hurry up.
Andy, this is a hoax, isn't it?
I'm sure it is, Jennifer.
Les comes through the door. He's wearing his coat and hat, but his arms are full of Buckeye News Hawk awards from his office wall. He's also carrying the Silver Sow Award. Les looks at Andy and Jennifer as he quickly walks out the lobby door without saying a word. Jennifer and Andy follow.
We come back to a dimly lit restaurant where Mr. Carlson and Joyce are looking pretty cozy, sitting in a booth. Joyce is leaning on Mr. Carlson as he shows her pictures of the baby. As he hands her another picture, she puts her arm on his back. He tells her this picture is when she got her first tooth.
Oh, she's adorable. She must really keep Carmen on her toes.
Yeah, I guess so. She usually sleeps when I get home.
Who, the baby?
Carmen.
Joyce is just a bit handsy, isn't she? Mm. She asks about little Arthur. Art tells her he's 15 now and wants to join the PLO. Joyce asks Art what time it is. He checks his watch and tells her it's 1:30.
1:30? My goodness, I'm going to have to get back to the station. I got stacks and stacks of work piling up on my desk.
Arthur, remember, I am one of two people who knows what a crock that is.
The PLO is the Palestinian Liberation Organization. We're guessing little Art is interested more in the mercenary options than the ideology of the PLO. The PLO was founded in 1964 on the West Bank with the purpose of establishing Arab unity and liberating the Palestinian territories currently under military occupation by the State of Israel.
Joyce tells Art she has an appointment, then leaning even closer to him. I don't know how she's getting closer
to him. I don't know.
She's
not practically on his lap.
She puts her hands on his arm. Joyce says,
"I never did get down to business."
And in kind of a throaty voice, too, Art looks at her, confused.
Well, I should have brought it up sooner, but believe it or not, I was kind of shy.
You were?
How about this afternoon?
I beg your pardon?
Well, you could come to my hotel room at the St. Mark.
Art's voice is shaky. He asked her if they couldn't just talk about this on the phone. She tells him, no, they can't talk on the phone about this.
This is a hot proposition.
Yes, Art is seriously misinterpreting what's going on here. But to be fair, Joyce is throwing out some very confusing signals. The touching, the closeness, even the language, using words like shy and proposition. Yes, as you probably figured out long before it was revealed, she's talking about a business proposition. We think she's intentionally making it seem like something more to lure him in.
What is her deal?
Yeah.
We couldn't find a Cincinnati hotel called the St. Mark. There is a St. Mark Catholic Church in Cincinnati and a St. Mark's Hotel on the Lower East Side of New York.
Art's a little shaky now. He nervously begins gathering up the baby pictures, saying he really should get back to the office and find out what the police are wanting. Joyce tells him she's leaving for Cleveland this evening.
Oh, gosh, bad luck. Have a good flight.
Art scoots out of the booth. Joyce tells him she'll call him when she gets back to her hotel.
I'll be there all afternoon.
Art is really nervous. He tells her goodbye and thanks her for everything. He hurries out of the restaurant, leaving Joyce in the booth alone.
Joyce mentioned flying to Cleveland. Now, Cleveland is about 250 miles from Cincinnati. You can drive it in just under 4 hours. If you want to fly, the fastest current option is 3 hours and 34 minutes for $210 each way. When you add in the trip to the airport and pre-boarding, you're better off to drive. It just sounds cooler to say you have
a you're flying.
Flight.
Yeah. Yes. Until they find out where you're flying to. We now see a tall radio tower as we hear Johnny's voice transmitting out over the airwave.
This is the doctor bringing you an afternoon of commercial-free music.
Feedback, John.
Can you fix it for me, man?
The camera follows the tower down to a small building at the base, and we see a little yellow hatchback parked outside the entrance. Johnny continues talking over the feedback. We see Johnny at the mic, and Venus is back at some dusty control.
Commercial-free music is something I'm sure our sales manager is not enjoying half as much as we are.
Johnny starts a record that begins playing kind of in slow motion, then it gets up to speed.
And Venus Flytrap, fascinating rhythms. Venus Flytrap will be with us a little early today with all the music that one man can carry. Speaking of music, here's the tune called Talk to You Later.
As mentioned, Talk to You Later was the other single from the Tubes album Completion Backwards Principle. It didn't chart, but it did prove the power of the new video music network, MTV, when it came to selling records. Even though the Tubes didn't get a lot of radio airplay, they were in hot rotation on MTV when the network debuted in August of 1981. You couldn't get MTV in New York or Los Angeles at the time. Suddenly, Tubes records were selling out in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Talk to you later. Tulsa had big cable penetration and were carrying the new network. MTV used the Tubes in Tulsa story to convince record companies why they should be making videos to go with their new releases.
Having a remote transmitter site is accurate, but that is not an AM transmitter tower. And you're going to call me a radio geek here, but Well, the tower they panned down when they first cut to the transmitter looks more like a general communications tower than an AM transmitter tower. Those round things are microwave relay dishes, and there are some shortwave antennas up on top. AM towers are a single stick. They're called mast radiators. They're the same size throughout their entire length. The reason is because the entire antenna is electrified, and you've got to have the same resistance over the whole thing. AM towers are normally segmented, and they're painted in alternating bands of red and white. The one they used looks a lot cooler than a real AM antenna. An actual AM antenna is a very thin stick. That's probably why they use this one. It looks better on TV.
So glad you cleared that up.
Well, I figured everybody was wanting to know about that.
Transmitters are located in remote sites for several reasons. Sometimes the position is determined by the FCC, so they aren't interfering with another signal in a nearby band. It's also sometimes to isolate the radiated power right at the transmitter. Having the transmitter downtown might create interference problems with other signal reception.
I got to visit the transmitter site several times at the first station where I ever worked. A small trailer out in a cornfield housed both our AM and FM transmitters. We had a transistor radio hanging on the FM transmitter so we could monitor what was on the air. At that distance, being right there in the same room with the transmitter, you didn't have to tune in the station. You could run the FM dial all the way up and down the band, and all you would get would be our station.
Now, that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, well, it's because of all the sideband and all the power from there. It just completely blows out the whole band.
Venus is looking over the equipment.
Boy, this place got some real history to it.
Ample evidence of a once proud civilization.
Venus recalls Andy told them this was the original WKRP studio.
Yeah, looks like the original WKRP dirt.
Johnny has picked up a racing newspaper, the Daily Racing Form, and he opens it up to read. Venus agrees this place is a dump. He asks Johnny when Andy said he would call. Johnny wonders out loud if maybe they hadn't blown up the building.
No, no. See, the signal's still coming across the air. It goes through a doohickey back at the station.
I'm in awe of your technical expertise.
And doohickey and thingamajig, both very important technical talk.
And don't forget the thingamabob.
Thingamabobs, too, yes. Johnny's reading the Daily Racing Form, or the DRF. Since 1894, the Daily Racing Form has been the original and official newspaper for horse racing aficionados and inveterate gamblers throughout North America. The company was founded in Chicago, but it quickly spread wherever there was horse racing. The DRF lists historical performance and today's races. At the time Johnny was using the DRF, there were 20 different daily editions published throughout the country. Each one covered a specific geographic area. Now, we noticed something about Johnny's DRF. It mentions Del Mar in the headline on the front cover, which is a racetrack in Southern California. Del Mar was covered by the Southern California edition of the DRF. That wouldn't be very useful to a DJ in Cincinnati.
Venus tells Johnny he hopes the phone's not out of order. Johnny tells him he does too because he's got to call Wing.
Oh yeah, that's Johnny's Chinese bookie, right? Wing.
Venus asks why. Johnny points to the racing form he's reading and tells Venus to look at it. Johnny then dials the phone.
Did you ever see such a name on a horse?
Terminal disease?
No, the one under that.
Oh, fever's break. Wow.
Venus tells Johnny that hunch bets are really dumb. Johnny disagrees.
Hunch bets? The gods are screaming in my ears.
Johnny is waiting for Wing to pick up. Venus shakes his head as he continues looking through albums.
Wing finally answers.
Wing!
Venus quickly comes up next to Johnny.
Give me 25 on the nose.
Sure.
Yeah, so much for those hunch bets. Johnny begins talking to Wing, then stops.
I don't believe it.
What?
He put me on hold. What kind of a bookie puts people on hold?
The kind that runs a busy Chinese restaurant.
Venus asks Johnny, when's post time? Johnny tells him 3, which means he's got 3 minutes and, oh yeah, your record's running out. Johnny quickly rolls his chair over to the mic.
Oh, no. Doctor here, bye-bye, here's Venus.
That's so mean. Caught off guard, Venus scrambles over to the mic while at the same time starting the other turntable. Johnny is yelling Wing's name over and over into the phone as Venus begins talking into the mic.
Thanks, John.
Wing.
We got a special early evening
Wing.
Here with nothing but wall-to-wall
Wing.
Music.
Venus slaps a hand over Johnny's mouth as he introduces the next song.
Now featuring the magnificence of the late Bob Marley.
Wing. We hear Could You Be Loved start playing. Johnny drops the phone from his ear with a defeated look on his face.
Hello?
Could You Be Loved comes from Bob Marley's May 1980 album, Uprising. This would be the last album from Marley. He had just succumbed to cancer in May of 1981 at the age of 36. Could You Be Loved was a huge hit internationally, showing up in the top 10 throughout Europe and the Netherlands. The U.S. never widely embraced Marley or reggae. The cut would not even make the Billboard Hot 100. Could You Be Loved is listed at number 363 on the Rolling Stone list of the 500 greatest songs of all time.
Back at the bullpen, we see Andy, Les, Bailey, and Herb coming in the glass doors. I guess they got the all clear. Les is carrying his awards back into the room, except for one of his NewsHawk awards, which Bailey is carrying for him.
Andy, this is the biggest news story we've ever had, and we're sitting on it.
Oh, it was only a threat, Les. There was no bomb.
Bailey places the NewsHawk award on top of the other awards that Les is holding in his arms. Les is not about to give up. He tells Andy this could get him on Al Schottelkotty's 6 o'clock evening news.
Or maybe even, dare I say it, the evening news with Dan Rather.
And now a special look at this episode's bandage placement for the 5-time Buckeye NewsHawk Award winner, Les Nessman. This is the Les Nessman Bandage Report. Now, here's Donna Stair with her report about Les Nessman.
Right, middle, and pointer fingers.
This has been a look at the bandage placement for Silver Sow and Copper Cob award-winning journalist, Les Nessman. Al Schottelkotty is a Cincinnati broadcasting legend. Dubbed the voice of Cincinnati, Schottelkotty anchored the WCPO News for 27 years starting in 1959. Al was known for several innovations in television news. He pushed to expand news from 15 minutes to half an hour. He's the one who created the early news slot at 6 p.m., and the reason Schottelkotty is most likely Les's hero, in 1967, under his management, WCPO added the Newsbird, one of the very first news helicopters in the United States. Les's sign-off is even a variation inspired by Schottelkotty's signature sign-off. He used to close every cast with,
"That is the news. Good news to you."
Herb asks Andy when they're supposed to make up all these commercials that this little prank has cost them. Andy tells Herb just about any time.
"We can run make goods till the cows come home. I shouldn't have to remind you that most of our sponsors canceled this year."
And this would be a call back to the last episode of last season, Cleanup Radio and Dr. Bob's Boycott.
Herb tells Andy it's not his fault.
"Herb, all I'm trying to say is maybe no commercials is a good idea. Helps build ratings."
Andy puts a hand on Herb's shoulder as Herb begins hyperventilating. Herb heads for the door that leads to the studio hallway and exits the bullpen.
Les asks Andy about the news.
"Why can't I go out to the transmitter too?"
Andy tells Les by the time he got out there, Johnny and Venus would be back at the station already. Andy picks up the phone and he begins dialing. Les tells Andy the news must go on. Andy assures him it will, and for him to get ready for his 4 o'clock cast. Les goes to his desk. Andy gets a busy signal on the phone and hangs up.
Mr. Carlson enters the bullpen. He's clueless as to what's been happening.
"You know, I had to wait outside to get in this building."
Bailey tells him it's because the police were looking for a bomb.
"Oh, they find one?"
Bailey shakes her head no and tells Carlson they covered every inch of the building, but it was a hoax.
"Well, you carry on. I'm going to go call my wife."
Carlson leaves the bullpen. Andy has the phone receiver up to his ear again.
"Well, there goes a man without a care in the world. Still busy."
Back out at the transmitter building, Johnny has the phone to his ear.
"Still busy."
Venus tells Johnny if he doesn't get through, don't worry about it. It's just a long shot. Johnny tells Venus he lives from one long shot to the next. This one's different.
"He can't lose.
You better hope he does. It's 3 o'clock.
Oh, no."
Johnny dials the phone again. There's a small radio near Johnny, and he turns the tuning knob to find the horse races. Venus is queuing up the next song. As the races begin, Johnny starts bargaining with God.
"Anything you want. My album collection, my band, clothes."
Listening to the horse race announcer.
The uncredited horse race announcer.
Fever's Break does not seem to be among the horses at the front. They've not heard his name yet. Venus smiles and tells Johnny it's fine. He's obviously going to lose. Johnny still isn't convinced.
"And trailing the field, it's Fever's Break.
See?"
Johnny just shakes his head.
We transition to the big guy's office where Carlson is on the phone with his wife. Cradling the receiver with his shoulder, Art is looking at one of his army men as he talks.
"Nothing. I just called to say hello and to tell you that I love you."
Hmm. Is the big guy feeling a little guilty?
I think so. Standing from his chair, Art tells his wife he has a great idea. Carlson tells Carmen he wants to leave work early and take her to dinner, then a movie.
He must not have gotten the response that he was hoping for. His smile fades, and then he says he understands.
No, it's just that we haven't seen very much of each other lately.
He tells Carmen that his feelings aren't hurt, and he knows about babies.
Oh, no, I'm not going out without you. No. No, uh-uh. What? Well, just because, that's why. Ah, come on now, don't insist.
Mr. Carlson then tells Carmen that maybe he'll just go by the club and have a drink. He tells her he loves her, and he hangs up.
Back out at the transmitter, Johnny is listening to the race, and he is not happy.
Fevers break. The 80-1 long shot in this race and a stunning come-from-behind victory pays off at mutuals of $166.46 to win, $72 to place, and $34.60 to show.
Johnny's taken off his glasses. He reaches over to flip off the little radio. Venus exhales and rolls his eyes as Johnny slowly replaces the receiver back onto the base of the phone.
Well, what the hell?
Johnny slowly turns to look at Venus.
Easy come, easy go, John.
Venus tells Johnny it's not the end of the world.
Besides, we got a job to do here, mister.
Johnny tells Venus he's right there.
Johnny stands, giving a little chuckle, and he asks Venus to hand him the toolbox. Venus puts the paper down that he was reading. He bends over to get the toolbox from the floor. Venus hands Johnny a large metal toolbox, telling Johnny that he thinks it's still locked. And then Venus goes back to reading his paper again.
Johnny tells Venus, that's okay. Then, raising the toolbox over his head with both hands, Johnny brings it down as hard as he possibly can on top of the phone. He hits it with three loud whacks, smashing the phone. Venus doesn't move. Johnny swipes the pieces of the phone off the desk onto the floor.
I think Johnny was a little upset.
Just a bit unhappy.
Back in the bullpen, Andy is sitting cross-legged on top of the DJ's desk, staring at the phone receiver. We can hear a busy signal coming from the receiver.
Bet they got the phone off the hook just to frustrate me. I can see them looking at each other and laughing at the thought of me going crazy.
Andy gently replaces the phone receiver.
Well, it won't work!
Grace under pressure?
Carlson enters the lobby.
Travis, you know that budget meeting you've been wanting to have with me?
Yes, sir, for some weeks now.
Well, you're in luck, Travis. Tonight's the night. I could go late.
Andy tells Art he doesn't think so. Bailey tells Mr. Carlson that Andy's going to help her reschedule all the spots.
Les comes in from the studio hallway door, and Mr. Carlson walks over to him.
Oh, Les, maybe we could discuss why you can't have that helicopter. You always like to do that.
Well, not now, Mr. Carlson. I'm sitting on the biggest news story of my career.
Oh, okay.
Maybe Herb would enjoy socializing with you.
Mr. Carlson looks at Herb's empty desk.
Yeah. Maybe I just go on home. Maybe catch the Dukes of Hazzard.
Bailey hurries over to Mr. Carlson.
I would like to discuss why we do not have any female DJs.
Yeah, I guess what I'm going to do is just go right on home.
Well, nuts.
Mr. Carlson's trying so hard because he's being tempted.
Fill that time. Art mentioned the Dukes of Hazzard. Ah, them Duke boys. The Dukes of Hazzard was an hour-long comedy on CBS.
Just a good old boy, never meaning no harm. Beats all you never saw, been in trouble with the law since the day they was born.
It and Dallas anchored their Friday night lineup. Bo and Luke Duke, played by John Schneider and Tom Wopat, respectively, were on probation for run and shine. In their home of Hazzard County, Georgia, the Dukes ruled the back roads with their souped-up, customized 1969 Dodge Charger named the General Lee.
Woo!
Woo-ha!
Making their way, the only way they know how. That's just a little bit more than the law will allow.
Even though they run afoul of the law almost weekly, the Duke boys are polite, church-going folk always ready to help a neighbor.
This thing ran for seven seasons and 147 episodes. We won't be doing a podcast on it.
No.
It became a cultural icon. It was the number two overall show on television in the 1980-81 season. We loved this summation line in the Wikipedia article about the Dukes of Hazzard. The episodes follow a similar structure. Out-of-town crooks pull a robbery or commit a crime. Duke boys are blamed, spend the rest of the hour clearing their names. General Lee flies, squad cars crash, no one is hurt, end with a laugh. This is the kind of mindless entertainment Mr. Carlson needs after a tough day at the office.
And with that line, you described every episode of the Dukes of Hazzard I've ever seen. Jennifer comes into the bullpen and tells Mr. Carlson Joyce Armour is on line two for him. Bum, bum. He tells her he'll take the call in his office, and he hurries out of the bullpen. Jennifer watches Art leave, then she goes over to Andy.
Andy, have you noticed?
Shh. Oh, excuse me, Jennifer, but I need to get some sound for my 4 o'clock news report.
Les is holding a small cassette tape recorder with a mic plugged into it.
I'm about to spring into action.
Of course you are.
Jennifer leaves the bullpen.
All right, hang on a second. What was Jennifer about to say when she started... Hey, Andy, have you noticed something about Mr. Carlson and Joyce? Has Jennifer noticed?
I'm wondering. She seemed all ready to gossip when she was heading over there.
Not much gets past Jennifer. Les blows into the mic from the tape recorder a few times, and then he begins testing the mic.
Testing. 1, 2, 3. Here we go. 3, 2, 1. Hi. This is Les Messman. We're speaking with Andrew Travis, program director of the station that received the bomb threat this morning. Tell me, Mr. Travis, where were you when you got the note?
Oh, come on, Les.
Les makes a face and puts the microphone into his side.
Pretend you don't know me.
Andy gives in.
All right. I was in my office, Mr.
Messman.
Right. And I might add that I think you're making more of this than it deserves. It's merely a hoax. That's what I suspected in the beginning, and that has turned out to be the case here. Mr. Nessman, is it?
Yes. And so you weren't alarmed, even though the note was signed Black Monday?
Yes, that's right, Wes.
Les covers the mic by pushing it into his side again as he grimaces at Andy.
You don't know me. You have heard of me.
Andy nods his head and Les continues.
And so you weren't concerned, even though Black Monday was in the news last month, for blowing up a television transmitter in this reporter's hometown of Dayton.
Les puts the mic in front of Andy's mouth.
You see, most successful radio stations get this sort of thing all the time.
Andy stops suddenly as something has just dawned on him. He looks at Les.
Transmitter?
Les puts the mic back in front of Andy's mouth again. Andy's expression becomes very serious.
Oh, good Lord, that's it. Is that the transmitter, Les?
Andy rushes out the door that leads to the studio hallway.
There you have it, Dan. Back to you in New York.
We transition to the lobby where the door to Art's office slowly opens. Art comes out, quietly closing the door behind him. He puts both of his hands on his cheeks, rubs them down to his nose, then has a sniff. He claps his hands together. He's headed toward the door when Herb comes into the lobby and stops him.
Hey, big guy. Travis wants to cancel.
Herb stops talking and sniffs the air.
Is that old Spice?
What do you want, Herb?
Just a situation report, that's all. No commercials, no money, no station, no job.
No time.
Carlson hurries out the door.
You didn't think we'd get out of this one without talking about Old Spice, did you?
No, of course not.
Old Spice was originally created and manufactured by a man named William Lightfoot Schultz. He formed the Schulten Company in 1937 to produce a line of nautical-themed toiletries. The recent opening of Colonial Williamsburg had spurred an interest in all things early Americana. Schultz introduced a scent, Early American Old Spice, a product for women, in 1937. He said he based it on his mother's potpourri.
In 1938, Schulten introduced Old Spice for men. The first products were a shaving soap and the original iconic aftershave. Old Spice moved from being a shaving company to a fragrance company in the 1970s.
Wake up with Old Spice.
feel the spray on your face and the wind at your back. Come on, wake up to the freshness of the open sea with Old Spice. And get a super smooth shave with Old Spice Shave Cream.
The 70s and 80s saw the introduction of several new scents in the Old Spice lineup. In 1990, Procter & Gamble purchased the Old Spice product line from Scholten. That original Old Spice scent, the one created by Scholten, was dubbed Classic Scent in 2008. They started selling it using this slogan, "The Original. If your grandfather hadn't worn it, you wouldn't exist."
You may not have existed because Old Spice was your dad's
favorite. Oh, that was Dad wore that stuff by the gallon.
It made it easy at Christmas. We'd just get him a gallon every Christmas.
Oh, yeah. Get a big tanker of Old Spice and he's good to go.
He was very happy. Johnny and Venus are still out at the transmitter. We can hear Urgent by Foreigner playing. They are sitting side by side, chins on their hands, elbows on the desk. Johnny is cradling the toolbox.
Could have had class, Venus. Could have been a contender. Could have been somebody. Instead of a bum, which is what I am.
Venus tells Johnny things could be worse.
Could be sitting back at the station on top of a bomb.
Yeah.
Johnny nods and taps his fingers on the toolbox.
And hold it, they're zooming in on that toolbox. Are they saying Johnny's holding a bomb? They then pop up the three most hated words in all of episodic television from the 1970s and 80s. That's right, to be continued.
Bum, bum.
What if you forgot and you missed next week's show? What if dinner runs long or somebody stops by to visit? You'll miss part two.
I always hated that back then.
Hate to be continued.
Wait for a whole week. Playing in this scene is Urgent, the first single from Foreigner's 1981 album 4. Urgent came out of an experimental riff singer Mick Jones played for producer Mutt Lange. Then unknown Thomas Dolby was hired to program and play synthesizer on the track. Dolby had played a demo of a song called Urges for Lange. Mutt incorporated it into the song, and Urges became Urgent. This ain't urgent. So urgent. So urgent, urgent, urgent. Just wait and see how urgent my love can be. It's urgent, 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 urgent. The iconic sax solo is from Motown legend Junior Walker. Walker recorded the solo 12 different times. Lange ultimately used the first version because he liked the raw, rough edges. At number 4 on the U.S. Hot 100.
Johnny finishes us out with one of his favorites, a movie quote that could have been a contender quote, was spoken by Marlon Brando in the 1954 movie On the Waterfront. Johnny actually says the whole quote.
I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum. Which is what I am.
According to the AFI's 100 Years, 100 Movie Quotes, this is the third most famous movie quote ever uttered. Number 2 was also spoken by Brando when he said,
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
In The Godfather. And the number 1 movie quote from the first 100 years of movies?
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
So it's all over, and now we're on Pins and Needles. Our entire capper scene was spent telling us what's going to happen next week. So what is next week's episode, Donna?
We will be watching An Explosive Affair, Part 2, conclusion of the two-part series. WKRP receives a terrorist bomb threat. Mr. Carlson thinks he's being seduced by his former secretary.
That's going to do it for this episode of the WKRP Cast. If you'd like to watch along with us, make sure to check our show notes. Find us on social media. You can follow our Facebook page at WKRP Cast. For more WKRP fun, become a patron. Go to patreon.com/WKRPcast for behind-the-scenes fun, full interviews, and a whole lot more.
Got a question, comment, or correction? Let us know about it. Write us WKRPcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening.
Bye now.
May the good news be yours.
The WKRP Cast is not endorsed by MTM Enterprises, Shout Factory, or CBS. This podcast is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. WKRP in Cincinnati, the WKRP logo, and all names, pictures, and audio of WKRP in Cincinnati characters are registered trademarks of MTM, CBS, Shout Factory, or their respective copyright holders.
Almost forgot, fellow babies. Booger!